Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American to be nominated to the Supreme Court, brought down the separate but equal doctrine. Integrated schools worked with the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund and not only fought for human rights and human dignity, but also made them impossible to deny in the courts and in the streets. In a new biography, award-winning author Will Haygood details the life and career of one of the most transformative legal minds of the past 100 years. The name of his book is Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Will Haygood to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Wonderful to be here.
Certainly, you have been a journalist for a long time, best known for your book, The Butler. What brought you to the subject of Thurgood Marshall?
Well, I just thought it was a great courtroom thriller that had never been told when he was nominated by President Lyndon Johnson in 1967. He was the first African-American to be nominated to the Supreme Court. His hearings lasted 5 days, and they were stretched out over nearly 2 weeks. And every Supreme Court nominee before him, their hearings had lasted less than 5 hours. And also, when Marshall's nomination finally reached the full Senate, it sat in limbo for nearly a month. And so there was great drama in that. And his legal cases as a legendary NAACP lawyer, as a civil rights lawyer, upended racial segregation in the Deep South. So when he was being grilled by the very powerful senators who sat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, the leaders of that committee, James Eastland of Mississippi, Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Sam Ervin of North Carolina, and John McClellan of Arkansas, these were Southerners and Southern senators who did not like Thurgood Marshall for what he had done in his legal victories.
Tell us a little bit about what brought him to the Senate hearing in 1967, a little bit about his legal background that made him a choice.
Well, he graduated from Howard University School of Law, number one in his class, and by the mid-1930s, he was constantly on the road as an NAACP lawyer, and he had some stunning victories before the Supreme Court himself. There were several signal victories. There was Smith v. Allwright, which dismantled the all-white Democratic primary in the state of Texas. There was Shelley v. Kramer, a famous housing case out of St. Louis, Missouri. There was Sweat v. Painter, which integrated the University of Texas Law School. And, of course, in 1954, his titanic victory, Brown v. Board of Education, which desegregated the American public school system. In 1961, President John F. Kennedy appointed him to a federal appeals court judgeship out of New York. And then it was President Lyndon Johnson who made him his Solicitor General. And so when 1967 rolls around, Johnson had masterminded a vacancy on the Supreme Court. He nudged Justice Tom Clark to step down, and he did. And Johnson was really bent on integrating the U.S. Supreme Court. He thought the 1964 Civil Rights Act was the first nail. The 1965 Voting Rights Act was the second nail. And he thought the nomination of Thurgood Marshall, this gifted black man, would be the final nail in the coffin of white supremacy. And so Johnson had looked at it that way, and Thurgood Marshall was his man.
I want to touch on that a little bit more in a moment. I do want to go back to Thurgood Marshall's upbringing. You write very movingly about his life in Baltimore, where he really experienced these injustices of segregation firsthand, up close. And how did they form him, do you think? And that experience of growing up in Baltimore that not only brought him to his career path, but to the many decisions that followed after the hearing of 1967?
Mm-hmm. Well, When Thurgood Marshall was 15 years old, he fell deeply in love and something deep as Cupid's best arrow. And he fell in love with not a person, but with a 5-page document, the U.S. Constitution. And he looked at his country and he said, wow, I can't go there. I have to sit in the back of the bus. I can't try on a suit in that store. Something's wrong with this because every day I'm reading the U.S. Constitution and I'm in love with the U.S. Constitution and something's not adding up. And so he committed himself to making the rights embedded in the U.S. Constitution. He committed himself to making those rights real. Because he had been scarred by it. His mother and father had been scarred by it. His mother had a dream that her son, her gifted son, could go to the University of Maryland School of Law. But when Thurgood Marshall was ready to enter law school, the University of Maryland was not admitting blacks. And so he couldn't go there. So he went to Howard University Law School in Washington, which was overwhelmingly black. And later, Marshall sued the University of Maryland and won a case that saw the first black law school student admitted. And so Marshall had this sense of justice and righteousness that sort of melted inside of him when he was very young. And that's what he did all his life. He traveled throughout the South fighting these cases. He ended up arguing as a NAACP lawyer 32 times before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he won 29 of those cases. It is an astonishing record.
After day three of the hearings, you write in the book, about halfway through the book, you write about LBJ, and you say he implored his aides and all the senators whom he trusted through the years and whom he had helped in the past with special favors and appointments to help him get his nominee onto the Supreme Court. Few presidents worked the phones as he did. He kept the White House operators hopping at all hours of the day and night, and he'd bark for a butler to bring him some stomach medicine, and after he had taken his medicine, he'd get back on the phone offering a torrent of praise about a Supreme Court nominee. And when aides told him maybe he'd better get some sleep, he told them time and time again the nights were for other men who wanted to sleep, but not for him, not for LBJ. Why was it so important to him to get this man on the Supreme Court?
Well, he said that, and that's a great question. He said that after he finally won, he worked those telephones and he convinced 20 segregationist senators, 20 Southern senators, to not vote against Thurgood Marshall. He twisted their arm. He was a master of the Senate. He had been the Senate leader, Lyndon Johnson. And so he knew these men, and he knew how to cajole, how to make threats. And he went about it in a very intensive way. And not long after Thurgood Marshall had been confirmed, and the Southerners came within a handful of votes of causing a filibuster, which would have ultimately killed Marshall's nomination, but the White House was able to muster enough votes to win. But shortly after Marshall had been confirmed, Lyndon Johnson was in the White House one day, and he said, "Now, with Marshall confirmed, every black mother can look across her breakfast table in the morning and see her son or her daughter, and she can say to herself, my son or my daughter can someday become a United States Supreme Court justice." That very reality meant a lot to President Johnson, that a mother would be able to dream of that magnitude about her son or her daughter.
What ultimately led to his approval? What was it that ultimately was triggered after so many days where he was given the appointment?
Yes, There was a lot of racial unrest on the streets. As a matter of fact, on the last day of Thurgood Marshall's confirmation hearings, an enormous riot broke out in Detroit. And there was this flurry of letters to senators in Washington that this man should not be dragged through the mud. He should not be hurt anymore with these hearings. You are trying to tear down his reputation. He was enormously qualified. And so there was this onslaught of letters, very passionate letters, and I found a lot of them when I went to Texas to do research at the LBJ Library. Some senators started to turn around. They started to see the righteousness of this appointment. They did not want the unrest on the streets to continue. And the numbers sound as if it's a wide gap. The final vote was 62-11, but the Southerners came within a handful of votes of course, stopping the White House. They needed an overwhelming number of votes to stop a filibuster, the White House did. And they got that, but it was only by a handful of votes. And I think it was the charm and the threat of Lyndon Johnson. It was the hugeness of a Republican senator, Everett Dirksen, who supported Marshall, and he rallied other senators to come to the cause. And it was those 20 Southerners who President Johnson finally convinced not to vote against Marshall. And so that really was why he won. And he was just an enormously gifted lawyer. He may have been and may still be the greatest federal appeals court judge in the history of this country.
During 1967, you point out in the book that Washington was very much still a segregated city. How did it change once he was approved of the Supreme Court?
Well, one of the noticeable ways that it changed, enrollment of black law school students skyrocketed. Just the symbolism of having Thurgood Marshall on the high court meant so much. Law school applicants from people of color rose all around the country. And at the time he was appointed, he was the highest ranking African-American inside government in this country. And that was huge. I think a lot of the story about Thurgood Marshall has been overshadowed. This confirmation battle story had never been told, and I just saw it as a great thriller. And I think that Marshall's legacy is that, yes, Martin Luther King Jr. was a spiritual leader. He drew the spotlight. He was gifted at that. But it was Marshall, it was Thurgood Marshall, who changed the law. Without a Thurgood Marshall, then Dr. King couldn't have did what he did. Thurgood Marshall won that Smith v. Allwright case in Texas and allowed blacks to vote in the previously all-white Democratic primary. At that time, there was a young Senate candidate who started to win his elections. He became a very powerful senator. He became Senate leader. That was Lyndon Johnson. He became vice president, and then he became the president. You can argue no Thurgood Marshall, no Lyndon Johnson. And so the men were somewhat intertwined in their vision for the country. Johnson, when he left the White House, had called Thurgood Marshall and said in this deep Southern accent, said, "Thurgood, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book about the hell you caused me to get you onto the Supreme Court." And Mr. Marshall, he was still on the bench at the time, and he said, "Well, Mr. President, I'll do anything I can to help you." and he heard this southern voice again from the president, who said, "You can't imagine the hell you put me through to get you onto that court." And then they both laughed about it, but that's very interesting to me that President Johnson was going to write a book about this battle. And it was in the summer of 1967, a lot of unrest, anti-Vietnam protest. The nation was very unsettled. And in the middle of this, you have this great lawyer who is trying to get onto the Supreme Court, and you have these Southern senators who don't want him there. It's just a very cinematic story.
It is also a story that ends with his confirmation. Is it your intention, or was it ever your intention, to write of his years actually on the court?
I give you a brief overview of his years on the court, but I really had intended all along for the book to somewhat end after his victory. There have been books about his years on the court, and that just was not the sort of book that I wanted to write. I really wanted to take the reader inside of room 2228, where the Senate hearings took place, and then take you outside to Senator Strom Thurmond's hometown and show you his family and what made Strom Thurmond Strom Thurmond. And then I could take you to Mississippi, to James Eastland, Senator James Eastland's hometown, home state, and show you what made him James Eastland. And so the book bounces in and out of the hearing room. And by the time of that final vote, I want the reader to know, you know, who these people are, you know, what they love about this country, why they wanted to stop Thurgood Marshall. And they're very nuanced characters. I mean, they had wives and children, and they loved this country. They thought they loved the country as much as Thurgood Marshall did. But they were just on a different side of the civil rights battle, where a lot of blood, sweat, and tears flowed for the right to vote, for the right to use restrooms, for the right to drink at water fountains. And so, in a way, that 1967 confrontation between the Southern senators and Thurgood Marshall was like the last gasp of the Civil War.
The name of the book is Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court Nomination That Changed America. It is published by Knopf. Will Haygood, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Showdown. It's published by Knopf, by Will Haygood. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.